Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Marcellaro. And this week, my guest is the Tidbits Managing Editor, Josh Centers. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, John.
Hey, it's great to finally meet you after following you on Twitter and reading your stuff for so long. It's great to have you on the show. You are the Managing Editor of Tidbits, as well as the author of Take Control of iOS 11 and Take Control of Apple TV. And co-author of the Take Control of Preview, the Mac app. For those of you listeners who are not familiar with it, these are books published by Tidbits that are glorious and great, and they're downloadable, and help you understand key technology things you might be interested in. So, I was also curious to meet you because you live in Tennessee. I used to live in Knoxville for a few years.
Oh, cool.
When I was at the Oak Ridge National Lab, my boss said, don't buy a home in Oak Ridge, buy a home in Knoxville. And
right.
Commute up the Pellissippi Parkway, and that was good advice. So we bought a really nice house in Knoxville and lived there for a few years and worked at the lab. But, boy, was that a shock, moving from Colorado and being a skier.
Yeah. Not much skiing in Tennessee.
No, there is not. Gatlinburg doesn't count. It never did. We would drive to North Carolina, where there were a couple little tiny ski areas, mom-and-pop ski areas called Sugar Mountain and Beach Mountain. Although we did join the Knoxville Ski Club and had some glorious trips up to Snowshoe in West Virginia, which is a pretty nice ski area for the East Coast anyway. Not exactly Vail, but Snowshoe was nice. We had a good time there. How did you end up in Tennessee?
Oh, I was born here. I've lived here pretty much my whole life. Except for a few years when I was in college and I lived in Kentucky. But yeah, I've pretty much lived in this area my entire life. And, you know, when I was younger, I always intended to move out and go on to bigger, better things. And I just never did. And, you know, the funny thing is, you know, I used to think, oh, one of these days I'll move to California. But almost every job I've ever worked in the Tennessee area, it seems like most of the people I work with are from California. They're like refugees from California. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, California just kind of moved to me.
We have some of those in Colorado, too. Yeah. So tell me about your early schooling and career. Did you start off? Probably didn't start off being a writer, right? I'm guessing.
And, I mean, it was always sort of my career ambition. You know, I grew up reading, you know, Macworld and Mac Addict and, you know, various tech magazines.
Mac Week, maybe? Mac Week?
Yeah, I can't remember all the ones I read, and unfortunately, most of them are out of business at this point. My favorite one, and no one ever remembers this one, but it was one called The Net, and it was...
I don't remember that.
It was sort of Imagine Publishing. I used to love all their stuff, but Imagine Publishing produced it, and it was almost sort of like a spiritual successor to Mondo 2000. It had some of the same writers. But yeah, no one remembers it. It's just me. Yeah. So I always did want to be a tech writer, in some form or fashion. Mm. So I graduated high school, just barely. I was not a very good student, and, I didn't quite know what I was going to do with my life. At that point I was sort of more into the trades. You know, I was more into machining and welding and that sort of thing. But, you know, a lot of people close to me really wanted me to go to college, and I didn't know what to go to college for. And so I went to community college for journalism because I did have an interest in that. And it's something my dad had kind of encouraged when I was younger. And so I tried that out and ended up liking it and apparently being pretty decent at it. So went on doing that, and at some point I transferred to Western Kentucky University in Bowling Green, Kentucky, known for the infamous Bowling Green Massacre, so-called. And
was there a computer in your life? Like, were you glued to your Macintosh?
Yeah, well, I got into my first Mac was a PowerBook I got in 1999. It was a PowerBook G3 Lombard, but my first computer
was that the toilet seat one.
I think that was the iBook. No, I like legit like black PowerBook.
Oh, Power. That's right. I'm sorry.
Yeah. It had the it had bronze keys, and it had the cool thing. You could eject. There's like a little dock, like a little docking bay in both sides, and one side by by default, you had a battery. On the other side, you had an optical drive. And there was a little lever you could use to eject either one. So you just pop the battery straight out. Or, you know, you could put two batteries in there and have a laptop that lasts a really long time. Unfortunately, with that laptop, this is before MagSafe for USB-C or anything. And it had Apple used – you probably remember this. Apple used to have the worst – power connectors. And mine kept getting dinged up all the time. Like if you just bumped it the wrong way, something would get damaged in there.
My first notebook was a PowerBook 100, the little gray one made by Sony.
Oh wow!
But I don't remember much about the connectors. That was 1992.
Yeah. My first computer I ever had, I got around that time. It was like 1990 or so. It was a Tandy, like from Radio Shack, and it had something on it called Deskmate. That it was like a DOS shell. I don't know if you've ever heard of this. There's a lot of stuff in my youth that only I knew about that no one else remembers. But it was
really
like
early days.
Yeah, it was like Radio Shack's ripoff of Windows, and so the whole thing was like it was like blue and yellow.
Sounds great. Cough.
Yeah. It seemed cool at the time, but yeah. So in about 96 or so, I got a compact Presario of some vintage. I couldn't tell you what. It had like, you know, the Pentium processor and, you know, I think like 8 megs or 16 megs of RAM, something like that. And
megabytes, folks. 8 megabytes.
Yeah, yeah. So and then I got that PowerBook in 99, and over the years I just kind of kept jumping between, you know, I would run with Apple for a while and get irritated with Apple, and then go back to Windows for a while and get irritated with Windows. And then it was about, I don't know, 2011 or so, 2010, 2011, I started getting irritated. I had a really nice home-built gaming PC, but I was starting to get irritated with it because I wasn't gaming much. And this thing was just all sorts of fans and wires, and I decided to get myself a MacBook Pro. And I can't – it was like a 15-inch. I couldn't tell you the exact vintage of that. It was around 2011 or so. So, I mean, they're all about the same, you know, aluminum – all that stuff, and that's actually the machine that got me into professional tech writing.
The machine itself.
Well, yeah, in a sense, because I mean that's why I first started doing it with.
That's interesting. So, what was your first writing gig?
My very first. I think it was for Tidbits. I want to say. So what I started doing. I read this book called The Education of Millionaires. I can't think of the author's name at the moment, but one of the things it suggested in it, it wasn't in the book. It was like a blog post the guy had made somewhere else. And he was talking about if you want to get into something, just start, like, get yourself a website, like with your name. It's like yourname.com. So I've registered joshsenders.com. Don't bother going there. It's really out of date. And start a blog and start reading books about the thing you want to do, and start writing blog posts about the books. And it's really smart advice, because then anyone who's going to hire you, they're like, oh, wow, this guy knows a lot about this field. And so I decided, oh, you know, I'm going to read these books about copywriting, because I decided that was probably the best way to get a job in, you know, as a writer.
Interesting.
And I started just sort of accidentally writing about tech because I couldn't help myself. And Glenn Fleischman stumbled across one of my articles because I had noticed, I don't know, it was iOS 6 probably, and I had noticed that I was using a lot of data. And like cellular data, and I traced it back to iCloud, and I took a video showing how, I don't remember exactly where it was at, the video was floating around there somewhere from way back in the day, and it was, you know, I took a video showing how it was like ticking, it was like using data, you know, even when it wasn't supposed to be doing anything, until I turned iCloud off. And Glenn had been working on the same issue, and so he linked to my blog post and Tidbits, and that ended up, I ended up writing some articles for Adam over at Tidbits, and
so for the listeners, Adam and Tanya Angst founded Tidbits in 1990, and it's probably the longest running internet publications that we have.
Yeah, I think it actually is now, because there was some kind of Irish newsletter that was just a little bit older, and they eventually folded up. So now Tidbits takes the reins.
That's going to explain in a few minutes why you're managing editor there. You have history.
Right. And so I just started writing for some different places, and Glenn kind of hooked me up with some gigs, because he generally liked the cut of my jig, as they say. And,
did you write for Tool? I can't remember.
I don't think Tua, I ever wrote directly for Tua, but I did. They did invite me on their podcast every now and then, so I would kind of show up there and bum around.
Did you ever meet Kelly Guillemot?
Oh, yeah. I've met Kelly. We met at Macworld, the last Macworld back in, 2014. And we got along really well.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah, I've met a lot of the people from Tua. I've met Doc Rock and now my mind's blanking out on me as it does, but yeah, I met Brett Terpstra, of course, and Mike Rose and all those, all great folks. We all got along really well.
I got to get Mike Rose on the show. I've been following him too.
Should.
Yeah.
Mike's a nice guy. You need to get him on and ask him what Salesforce does, because I have no idea what they do.
I use Salesforce at Apple.
Okay.
It's a system whereby you, as a salesperson, put forecasts into a database, and then your boss can go through and collectively aggregate what the sales projections are. And sometimes they're a little dicey. You have to sort of put a credibility on there and a date. So if you think you're going to sell this laboratory 1,000 Macs, because you've talked to the CIO, you put that in there, and then you put it in there with low credibility, and then later he comes back at you and he says, well, you put it in there, why didn't you sell it?
Right.
But it's sort of a projection tool, and it does other things too, but that's what it's about.
See, I've asked probably a dozen people over the years, and that's the straightest answer I've ever gotten. I have a friend who's had the same problem, and he's started thinking that he has a conspiracy theory that Salesforce is some sort of cult.
Well, it's certainly a magnificently designed user interface and database, and many companies just sort of live and breathe it because it's so quantitative. It allows people to extract data and do PowerPoint slides and give projections and say, well, in quarter two, 2018, we're projecting sales of XXX million dollars, and everybody smiles. Where did you get that? Oh, from Salesforce. Oh, aggregate of all the salespeople. They put the data in there. Oh, yeah, wonderful, wonderful. Pat on the back. Yeah.
So I used to do stuff kind of like that, except I used Excel for everything, like a Neanderthal. But also,
like an animal.
Yeah, like an animal. I mean, Excel is one of those things that a lot of people don't understand. A lot of companies, that's the only tool you have. And so, you use it for everything.
Yeah. So when did you ascend to the position of managing editor at Tidbits then?
So this is around the spring of 2013, and I'd been contributing to Tidbits, and I'd also gotten in the habit of, and here's a little career advice for people out there, if they get in a position like that, I was sending like edits in the middle of the night to stuff. Like I would, like, they would publish an article, and I would read over it, and I would send in little corrections and stuff. Mm. Which I turned out, actually there's some people in the Apple community that do that anyway, just for fun. You probably know some of them, John.
Some of them are polite and graceful, and some are not.
Yeah. But anyway, I guess that kind of got me a little better attention, and I kept kind of dropping a hint at Adam, more like pestering him, because my first kid was on the way, and I was like, hey, I'd really like to be able to stay home and take care of the kid.
That's not an unusual story, by the way. I've had over 100 guests on the show since I started, and that's ringing some familiar bells. Being in the right place at the right time, knowing somebody, making yourself aware, putting yourself out there, developing a relationship and a network, and then popping the question at the right time, and then it happens.
Right, and they kind of surprised me one day. I was driving home from the job I was working then, and Adam just all of a sudden texted me. He's like, hey, Well, actually, I think I saw it in Google Docs first, because they shared my employment contact me in Google Docs, and it was like, oh, hey, Adam's sharing managing editor contract with you. I'm like, oh, crap. I nearly crashed my car, I think. I was driving up a hill. I was like, oh, crap. And he texts me and says, oh, yeah, I shared a little something with you. Why don't you check that out when you get a chance? And I drove to my wife's work. My wife's a school teacher, and she runs the theater program there. So I just kind of bounced in the auditorium and told her, and there was a bunch of hooting, hollering, and hugging and all that.
Congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah. And so, yeah, I'm just super lucky to do it. I mean, it's one of those things that...
Is that a full-time job for you?
Yeah. I mean, well, technically it's part-time, but it's... You know, the beautiful thing about living in Tennessee is that it's not an expensive place, you know, and an amount of money that would, I don't know, winning, you know, buy a pizza every week in some parts of the country, you can make a pretty decent living in Tennessee doing. And then I do side work too, you know, because I have the time for it, like mostly take control books. I've contributed to some other publications in the past, like Sweet Home. So technically, I can call myself a New York Times writer, a contributor.
Oh, really?
Very technically. I did some work for them. The only thing I ever got published, though, is now a very outdated guide to trash bags. So it technically counts. I wrote a little something for Boing Boring. I wrote an article for the magazine. If you or your listeners remember that thing, it was
That Glenn's thing?
Yeah, well, it started as Marker Armitz, and then Glenn bought it after like a month or two.
Yeah, I've sort of forgotten about that. Did that go away?
Yeah, unfortunately, just wasn't a sustainable business. Well. One of the things that happened to it, I mean, you really should ask Glenn about all that, but my view, and Glenn insisted this wasn't the main thing, but to me it always seemed like the main thing, and that's the newsstand. It got stuck in newsstand, and Apple just kind of neglected it before they killed it, and I know it probably wasn't the main thing, but it didn't help. So unfortunately, that did go away, you know, and it kind of seemed to be the end of a very optimistic era in online publishing. But you know, these days I mostly just work on Tidbits and Take Control, and you know, don't stress myself too much.
Very cool. It's been a great career. So we have to take a short break right now. In the second half of the show, I want to talk tech talk with you. We've talked about having some special topics dear to our hearts, both of us on the show. So we'll get to those in the second half of the show, folks. We'll be right back after this short 60-second commercial break. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thank you. I'm with Tidbits Managing Editor Josh Centers. So we talked about some stuff we wanted to talk about during the show, and I just lit up and I went, oh, this guy thinks just like I do. The problem is that Apple does so many things right, and they're so big, and then they do so many things that are infuriating. And you have to write about both. And it makes you seem bipolar at times, because one day you wax enthusiastic, right, and then the next day people go, what kind of bandwagon is this guy jumped onto? And then, because, you know, Apple doesn't do everything perfectly. There's the way we would like Apple to run, but, you know, as journalists with good sound backgrounds and experience, we know, you know, when Apple needs to be brought on notice about some things that they're doing. And so that kind of sets the stage for some of the things we're going to talk about. So the first thing you wanted to talk about was the iPhone 10, and we're kind of in the same boat on that too, because this morning on a podcast with Jeff Gamet, I talked about that. How are you feeling about an iPhone 10?
Well, right now I feel irritated having to be up in the middle of the night to order one again. I mean, you know, and
it gets
I'm going
to
put I'm going
to
pause and put an asterisk here, because I know somebody listening to this is going to get infuriated by us talking about this, because we're, you know, privileged dudes who get to do this for a living, and so, you know, it is kind of a privilege to, oh hey, I'm, you know, I need this iPhone for my work. But when you have to do it every year and your livelihood kind of depends on it, it gets really old.
It does.
And well, the other thing, I mean, it just seems like, I mean, and just as someone who does care about the person who, you know, just wants a phone, you know, it's annoying. You know, you shouldn't have to be up at the, you know, with the chickens or before the chickens. I have chickens, so I can talk authoritatively about this. But I mean,
it's,
you know,
what, 2 a.m. for you when that happens?
Yeah, 2 a.m. So, you know, it's just kind of ridiculous. And it's even more ridiculous now because I'm on the iPhone upgrade program. And so I got the little message. Actually, I did this before I got the message because I'm anal retentive like that. I went and checked the Apple Store app, which is always the best way to do these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And it was like, oh yeah, you can pre-qualify for an iPhone, like it's a home loan or something. But so I went through and did all the stuff, and I, you know, picked out the one I want. I gave it all the Verizon crap and payment method and address and blah blah blah. And it was like, okay, we'll just come back here and at 2 a.m. on this date and tap a button and you'll have an iPhone. And it's like, well, you already know what I want. Just put me in the queue and just send me one when you get it. Why do I have to get up?
I have written the same thing. Why can't we do that? Why can't we just throw a hat in the ring, just order it, and just say, okay, here's my credit card number. And you don't get up at 2 in the morning. You just wait and they just ship it.
I think a lot of it, I think Apple likes the commotion. I think they want lines. They want people panicking because they can't get
You feel
get
like
fun.
You're in a street fight at 2 in the morning with the clicking and tapping and
yes.
Fussing and going, oh, well, that didn't work. And, oh, reload. And, oh, am I going to get it? And then you fuss and fuss. And then you're watching
fails.
The clock. And, you know, see 30 seconds go by and you go, oh, my God, in 30 seconds, there must have been 2 million people who ordered the phone they want. And then by the time you get your click successfully go through, oh, we're out of 64 gig phones. You must buy a 256.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
It's rose gold for you now.
Right.
You're getting the pink phone now. It didn't click fast enough.
It's certainly an experience going through that.
Yeah.
It's some sort of rite of passage where
every
fall you have to go out and fight a mountain goat.
Yeah. you have to bring a sacrifice to the temple.
Right.
You know, burn offering. Well, it can be kind of fun because, you know, even if you're at home, you get on Twitter and, you know, and you goof around with your Twitter friends about, you know, your Slack or whatever. And, you know, and of course, and this happens every year. And this is the most irritating part. 2 a.m. or whatever rolls around and the stupid site doesn't work.
Right.
Like, and it was like 2 or 3 years ago, it was 4 a.m. until the site worked. And then here's the funny part. This is how this always works out. I'm always up at 2 a.m., always fighting with the server and web objects and all this. Adam Inkst, he just wakes up at like 8 a.m. or whenever, or just like a normal leisurely time, and logs on, orders it, and he gets it like before I do every single time.
I did that last year with the iPhone 7. I just didn't feel like getting up at 1 a.m. Colorado time, so I got up at 8 o'clock in the morning and I pulled my iPad mini off the nightstand. And 8 o'clock in the morning, I would have ordered just the iPhone 7 I wanted. But I don't think that's going to work this time.
See, it's kind of it's almost like a prisoner's dilemma this year because, so I'm on the upgrade program. I get to upgrade once every 12 months. So I let 1 month slip by because I took one look at the iPhone 8. I was like, nah. Wow. I mean, I love my iPhone 7. Yeah. Well, I mean, I talked to Joe Kissel at Take Control, you know, the day of the announcement. I was like, well, I'm guessing I'm going to need to get the iPhone 10. And they're like, yeah, because we don't know how it works. Somebody has to know how it works. You know, I write the iOS book for Tech Control, so I have to know this stuff. And so I have to have real hands-on experience with the thing. So professionally, I kind of need it. Personally, I'd rather just keep my iPhone 7 Plus for a few different reasons. First of all, I'm kind of a curmudgeon, and I'd really would just have one phone to keep for like 10 years.
You're too young for that. I can be a curmudgeon. You can't.
I was born this way. And well, the other thing too, I'm skeptical about the iPhone 10 is that it's really skinny. It's as skinny as a regular iPhone, and I know up front I don't like that because I like the big wide iPhone 7 because I have my hands get cramped wrapping around those little skinny phones, and I have kind of stiff fingers. I don't like squeezing them into a ball all the time. It makes my hand hurt. It makes my hand cramp up. So with the Plus, I don't have to do that. I can just kind of hold my hand out flat. I'm doing it right now. I hold my hand up flat and just kind of have the phone there, and it just kind of stays in place. So I already know I'm going to hate this thing before I even order it.
Well, it gives us something to write about.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's always chasing the high.
You are. So let's see if we get hit the same line on the Macs. Because you told me some things about your feelings about the Mac that resonated with me. Of course, we all went through the long shadow valley of death and deprivation from 2013 to 16. Then we had the glorious coming out at WWDC. And it looks like the Mac lineup was going to get back into shape. But you still have some concerns, and I do too. You start. Mm-hmm.
I'll start with the positive. I'll start on a positive note. The 27-inch Retina iMac, incredible machine. I can't recommend it highly enough. But you know what? It's not new. The problems. The main thing. I mentioned in our email. I mean, Mac Pro may be here, maybe not. Mac Mini might as well be dead. That's a whole show in itself. Of irritation.
But Tim Cook said the other day he still wants to. Let's just carry on.
It's important.
It's important. Like, yeah. Keep on buying the old one. It's so important.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, I mean, okay. So to go off on the Mac Mini for a minute, what really ticks me off about it is, so it's been a few years since they updated it, but when they did update it, they actually made it worse than before.
Right.
It actually has a slower processor.
Jim Tanis ripped it. Good.
Yeah, and then they open the thing up and fill it full of hot glue so you can't replace anything. I mean, this is literally what they did. If you open up if you try to open one of the newer Mac Minis as compared to the 2012 model, it's like they filled it with glue so you can't replace anything in it.
I'm looking forward to a Mac Mini that's sort of like the new Hewlett Packard's, like the Z2 Mini, just glorious, beautiful, stock, just full of power, quad core. Lots of memory, high-end i7.
Yeah.
Yeah, just loaded with good stuff and a fast graphics processor. A machine that's worthy to put on your desk. If you have your own displays and you can't afford... Here's the thing. If you want to run a headless Mac and you have your own favorite kinds of displays, whatever they are, Dell, Hewlett Packards, and you can't afford the coming Mac Pro and you don't want to use the 2013 Mac Pro because it's getting really long of tooth and slow... Mm-hmm. What are you going to do? You're not going to pay $7,000 for a 2018 Mac Pro? A nice little $800, $900 Mac Mini that's just bursting with power and has all sorts of good ports on the back. It's flexible, clean, good looking. That would be great. So what's taking them so long?
Right. Well, there's two things with that. I think, first of all, I don't think Apple... I don't think they want to sell you a standalone machine. They want to sell you something that has a screen in it. iMac, MacBook, iPad. They're just kind of adverse to selling you
a box.
That's
so irritating.
It really is, because I'm 100% with you on the Mac Mini. I think the other thing is, too, I don't think they like selling Intel chips. I think they really want to sell you an ARM-based Mac, but I don't think they really know how to do that yet.
You think they're going there? Really?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the benchmarks, I mean, the Apple processors are destroying everything else in mobile. And at this point, they're catching up with Intel, because Intel's not advancing that fast. So, I mean, it's only a matter of time until Apple, you know, blasts them out of the water.
Yeah, but you'd have to rewrite Mac OS for ARM. The developers would have to recompile. We'd have to go through
a
Rosetta phase of, you know, running your old Intel apps like we ran the old PowerPC apps. You wouldn't be able to have boot camp and run Windows and Intel x86 binaries directly on an Intel chip.
And that's probably
all
the biggest thing.
All sorts of problems.
Yeah. Probably the biggest thing is it would kill the Windows compatibility.
Yeah, I don't know if Apple's ready to do that. That's why I'm not buying it.
I think that's what they want to do. Right, I'm not sure if it's something. I'm not sure if they'll ever do it, but I think that's something, because I have the same terrible mindset about stuff. It's why I'm such a bad procrastinator. I'll think, you know, I want to do this, but then there's this. Oh, I can't do this perfectly. Oh, okay, well, I'll think about it. Like, you know, and they just keep putting it off. But it's clearly not a priority, right? But the one lineup that seems to be under a lot of people's skin right now is the MacBook Pro.
You know what pisses me off about the MacBook Pro line? You can't get a quad core in the 13-inch size.
Oh, yeah. That is annoying. Yeah. Well, see, Apple's got this weird thing where they associate the size of the screen with the capability of the machine.
I know, and that's so wrong.
Right.
It's wrong.
It's such a dumb way to think about computers. I mean, I guess they're thinking, I mean, the typical person who isn't that computer savvy. Like, I'll just tell you a very quick story. I was in Best Buy one day, and I saw this dude who was there trying to help his daughter get a computer, and he saw a 27-inch iMac. He's like, whoa, now that's a computer. You know, because to him, big screen equal big computer. You know, so it makes sense in a way, but they're selling these machines to professionals. We don't think that way. You know, it's like, oh, wow, that's a big laptop. That must be the fast one. You know, I mean, maybe it's a heat issue, but the big thing people are irritated about is the keyboards, which I actually like the keyboard. I have a 2016 MacBook Pro. It's like the first one with the touch bar. Besides the touch bar itself, I do like the keyboard because it's nice and clicky. But people have had I know they're not popular, and people have had problems with them, like a little piece of dust will get in there, and suddenly the key doesn't work. So it's so bad, Jonathan Mann wrote a song about it.
Well, the keyboard on Jeff Gamet's 2016 MacBook Pro failed. He had to send it in and get a new keyboard. I like the keyboard on my 2015 MacBook, the butterfly mechanism. I just love it.
Yeah, so it's a similar thing, I think, the MacBook to the MacBook, the newer MacBook.
They kind of did. I don't think they stayed with the pure scissor mechanism on the newest MacBook Pros, did they? They kind of like did a butterfly, but they kind of made it a little clickier.
Yeah, they made it a little clickier. And see, this is one of the things that irritates people about this keyboard, is it's kind of loud. It is very clicky. Let me see. Let me just open this up, because I have it right here. Let's see if you can pick it up on my microphone here. I'm just going to...
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's super loud.
Now, I'm going to type on my Apple aluminum keyboard and see if you can hear it.
Yeah, a little bit.
A little bit. Yeah.
I mean, I got the old Apple wireless, and of course, that's right next to the microphone, too. The funny thing is the MacBook Pro is sitting, like, I don't know, 2 or 3 feet away from the microphone, and it was that clear. It's super loud, which I thought people liked, so I don't know. I guess I don't understand people anymore.
I think you do. I think you do.
But I have a friend. I have a friend who he's wanting to get into making YouTube videos. He's sort of a blue collar guy who got really into investing, and he figured out he's really good at it. He wants to do YouTube videos to get people to teach people how to invest like he does. And anyway, so he wanted a new laptop, and he showed me a video. Had a the guy made it with QuickTime. He's like, well, how do I do that? I'm like, well, you need a Mac. And so we went back and forth, and he was like, well, can't I just get this MacBook Air? It's a lot cheaper. I'm like, no, it's really out of date. And he finally ended up getting – he spent like $2,600 on the thing. He's got the money, but it's still – it's like he bought top-of-the-line 15-inch MacBook Pro. I don't know if he hasn't gotten it yet. I don't know if he's going to like it or not, but – you know, at the same time, it's like there's all these keyboard problems and all this and that. And it made me just realize I used to have no problem recommending an Apple computer. And this time, like, I had to call the guy. You know, you used to be like, I'd be like, look, just get this one. I actually had to call the guy and walk him through it and say, look, you know, here's the downsides of whatever you get.
And we could spend another whole show talking about the touch bar, but we don't have to get into that. So we are running out of time, actually. And so... we got to leave the subject of MacBook Pros and move on to one more subject, which you and I also, I think, are in sync on. And that is the glorious or the inglorious Apple TV and now the Apple TV 4K. Boy, did they take their time bringing that out.
Yeah, yeah, for real.
Why didn't Apple get on the 4K bandwagon along with Amazon and just ship a new one? You know, they didn't have to have HDR, but the fact that they had an Apple TV that could support 4K... bring on the HDR later, you know, but why wait so long? What do you think?
Well, yeah, you know, it's a good question. I think a lot of the deal with HDR is that for most people, 4K doesn't matter. I mean, even if you have a 4K set, you have to have a very large one or you have to sit very close to it to really notice a difference. And even then, it's a subtle difference for the most part. So, but now HDR, if you watch some HDR content,
makes all the difference.
Oh yeah. It's night and day. I mean, HDR is such a bigger deal than 4K.
Yeah. But my argument is that even though you couldn't see the difference, if Apple had brought out a 4K, Apple TV,
yeah,
they would have been developing the technology curve. They would have been in there with the other guys. They would have been perhaps not losing market share to Roku and Amazon Fire TV, which made a big deal of it. And got people's mind share, and then the Apple TV slowly declined in market share. So technically, you're absolutely right. Oh, nobody can see the difference. We shouldn't do it. That's like saying, yeah, we're not going to compete. We're not going to throw our hat in the ring and compete.
No, and I agree with you. Okay, here's the problem. I mean, out of the gate, so Apple comes out. It's kind of weird because they spent a long time working on this thing, and then some stuff happened behind the scenes, and they had to rush. They basically rushed this thing on a market, just kind of half finished.
The 4K one or the old one?
The fourth generation model.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, they came out, and everyone else at this point's 4K. It's like a 4K $100 box, and they're like, yeah, ours is $150, and it's not 4K. Oh, you can also spend $200 on it. Actually, I think it was a little more than $150. I think it was, I can't remember exactly what the price was. But they were just behind in the first place. Mm-hmm. And sort of their excuses, well, we're Apple. And, you know, it'll be better. Well, the big thing was.
We're the phone company. We don't have to care.
Well, I think part of the sales
pitch. That's a Lily Tomlin line.
yeah. The part of the sales pitch is the App Store. And they're like, look at all this cool stuff developers are going to do. And I know some tvOS developers, and they bought into it. They developed the apps. They put them out there, and no one cared. Like, no one bought them. It was a huge chicken and egg thing. And so Apple, I think, just totally miscalculated the market. And you know what the big thing is in TV right now? And this is kind of underground, but this is the big thing. I've had at least a dozen normie people, not technical people, just normal people tell me about this. Like, hey, you need to check this out. You get an Amazon Fire Stick, and you put the software called Kodi, K-O-D-I, on it. Mm-hmm. It's not available for Apple TV. It used to be called Xbox Media Center. And you install these plugins, so you get all this pirated stuff for free. And this is what, you know, and it's a $40 stick. That's what most people care about. Most people care about just not spending a lot of money on it. Apple totally misread that market. Apple's like, we can give them a premium experience and they'll pay for it. No, people want to pay for as little for TV as possible.
That's right. Well, guess what? We are out of time. We didn't get to nearly all the things I wanted to talk to you about, but this has been great. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's been a lot of fun. It was great to meet you and talk to you for the first time and hear about your thoughts. GMTA, that's my motto for this show. So... Thanks again for joining me, and it was a great time. Tell the listeners how to contact you if they wish.
You can always follow my rantings and ravings on Twitter at jcenters. I can be reached if you go to tidbits.com. You can see my articles there. I am josh@tidbits.com. Also, if you go to takecontrolbooks.com, that's where you'll find my books.
All right. Great. Thanks again for joining us. And folks, thank you for coming by and listening. You've been listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We will see you next week.